The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're looking at the science and the history of the water that makes life and society possible. A little later, I'll speak to Juan Liu, chemistry professor at the University of Waterloo, about his work using DNA to detect waterborne impurities that could make water unsafe. But first, I'm joined by James Salzman. James holds joint appointments at Duke University as the Samuel Fox Mordecai Professor of Law and as the Nicholas Institute Professor of Environmental Policy at the Nicholas School of the Environment. In more than 6 books and 70 articles and book chapters, Jim has addressed topics spanning trade and environment conflicts, drinking water, environmental protection in the surface economy, wetlands migration banking, and the legal issues involved in creating markets for ecosystem services. He's here to talk about his new book, Drinking Water, A History. Good to have you here, Jim.
Thank you.
Now, water seems to have always held something special for humans. It's almost acted as more of a symbol than a resource, or maybe it became a symbol because it's such an important resource?
I think that's right. I mean, if you think about actions that are truly universal, there really aren't many, and drinking water is one of them. If you go back through really any settled civilization, you're going to find two things. The first is that they're going to have sophisticated engineering for their time to get access to safe drinking water, safe for them, and to protect the drinking water source. And you find that no matter where you look, there's always some type of engineering, whether it's Machu Picchu or Masada or ancient settlements in Jordan. The second thing you find is that water in every culture has some type of metaphysical or supernatural meaning, whether it's baptism or living water in Christianity, or sprites and local demigods around springs in other places. So water both has a physical and a metaphysical aspect in every culture.
Well, there also seem to be laws around water in a lot of cultures.
That's right. So drinking water is a scarce resource in many places. And I teach law, and one of the things that I teach my students is that anytime you have a resource that is valued and that is scarce, you need to have rules for allocation. Who gets to drink? Who doesn't get to drink? And one of the reasons I wrote this book in the first place, I was really interested by this conflict in Cochabamba and really the globalization battles more generally about whether there is a right to water or water should be treated as a human right. And I was curious just whether this was a recent conflict or one that has been going on for a long time. And what I found, and this is a large part of the book, is that water has taken on different natures, different meanings in different societies at different times. And so if you go back to the Bible, there was a right to water. In fact, the sale of water was seen as sacrilegious because water is a gift from the gods. You go to ancient Rome, and people paid for water and didn't give it a second thought. And then you find sort of more modern, it's sort of a hybrid. In some respects, water is a right, and in some respects, water is a commodity.
Well, I guess the most famous water system was in ancient Rome, the aqueducts. So maybe give us some background on them.
Sure. So Rome is really the first great hydraulic civilization. I mean, it's quite stunning that 2,000 years plus after the Roman Empire, you still find their water pipes, right, their aqueducts standing and standing sturdy and stable. And they were masterful engineers. But it wasn't just the engineering. They also understood the economics of water. And so, as you mentioned, the aqueducts brought water into Rome and some of the other Roman cities as well. But it's important to realize the aqueducts brought water in initially for reasons that have nothing to do with drinking water. The first was to bring water in for the baths, which were the social center for ancient Rome. The second thing that they needed water for, and this was one of the great insights of the Romans, was waste, sanitation. They realized you need water to take waste away from the population. And this was something actually that was forgotten or lost after the fall of the Roman Empire. So much of the water was brought in to bring the waste out. And after about the 9th or 10th aqueduct, there was an aqueduct called the Marcia that was brought in, and that brought in drinking water. and the drinking water was free for the taking for most people. There were these essentially basins in the public thoroughfares. You can see them in pictures of Pompeii today, called the Lacus. And you were limited only by how much water you could carry. But some people liked to have water piped into their homes for fountains and for baths. And for those people, they had to pay essentially a fee. It was called a vectigal. And because the water was gravity-fed, the price for the vectigal, the price they paid was based on the diameter of the pipe. The bigger the diameter, the more water you got, the more you paid. And the Roman brilliance was to take the funds that were raised by the vectigal and apply those to the cost of the water system. And we use that system to a certain extent today, and it's basically called it's cross-subsidized provision of a service. And they had this figured out over 2,000 years ago.
Was that a contentious political decision at the time?
It doesn't seem to have been. And what's interesting is that depending on who you were, you either saw water as a right if you got your water from the public locus, or you saw water as a commodity if you got it piped into your home. And so, you know, we have these debates today about what water is. And the Romans had this figured out 2,000 years ago. It was both.
Okay, let's jump ahead to New York in the 1770s. What was the water system like then?
It was terrible. When the Dutch first settled New York, Peter Stuyvesant, the governor, didn't allow funds for the digging of public wells. And so when the British came up the Hudson, the Dutch surrendered very quickly because they went inside their fort and realized they had actually no sources of water. So they couldn't withstand a siege very well. So one of the first things the British did was to dig some wells, but over time they stopped that as well. It basically made it a private responsibility, and most of the water was collected from a pond called the Collect, about Broadway and 30th now. Over time, the Collect just became terribly polluted. There were tanneries. New York was becoming more urbanized. There's a wonderful quote of a Swedish botanist named Peter Kalm. Was visiting New York in the 1740s, and he said the water was so bad that horses from out of town would refuse to drink it. And so it was just awful. And so in the 1770s, the local government in New York City decides they can do something about it. So they actually issue money, first money issued by a city in the United States, probably North America. And they're going to build these aqueducts with steam-powered engines. It's going to be a huge undertaking, basically hopefully to rival Rome. What they find, though, is that their timing is terrible, because soon after they start building, the Revolutionary War starts, and the British invade New York, occupy it, and destroy all the waterworks. And so at the end of the 1700s, New York's water is as poor as it was 100 years earlier. And there are fires that are breaking out, there are no hydrants anywhere, cholera, typhoid is a problem. And so you get a very bizarre business venture. And two people who are very unlikely, a man called Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton. Aaron Burr was the former vice president of the United States. Alexander Hamilton was the first secretary of the Treasury. And 7 years later, Aaron Burr would kill Alexander Hamilton in a duel. But at the moment, they were business partners. And Burr went to the state legislature for New York up in Albany and got them to grant a charter to something called the Manhattan Company that was going to provide water, pure and wholesome water, is what the charter says, for the city of New York. The assumption was that they would get a pipe from the river in the Bronx, which was still clean back then, and pipe it into Manhattan. Aaron Burr, though, was a scoundrel of the first degree, and he wasn't interested in providing water really at all. So what the charter did is it gave this company the authority to raise up to $2 million. And so he does that immediately. He only spends 10% of it, though, in providing water. And the water he provides is from the Collect. He takes the other 90% and he loans it with interest. Essentially, he wants to operate a bank, but without the restrictions of a bank charter. And this, the Manhattan Company, eventually becomes the Chase Manhattan Bank. I think now it's J.P. Morgan. So it's the first bank in the world that's founded because of drinking water. And if you actually look at the logo for Chase Manhattan, it's the cross-section of a wooden water pipe. And until the early 1900s, the Chase Manhattan Bank still pumped water because they were afraid of losing their charter.
Now, you mentioned cholera. So what was people's health like at that time?
By our standards, it was terrible. By their standards, it was basically what you know, life was cheap. One of the most interesting aspects of writing this book was trying to get a better sense of what we mean by safe drinking water. Because, you know, we're concerned about contaminants in our water in parts per million, parts per billion, even parts per trillion in some cases. If we were put in a time machine and went back 150 or 200 years, you couldn't pay us to drink the water. When we travel in developing countries, oftentimes we don't drink the water. But of course, for the people at those times and in those places, the water is safe enough. And so one of the sort of key things understanding how we think about safety is, first of all, background expectations. And second of all, our notion of what is it that actually causes disease. And so up until the Middle Ages, people talked about the four humors. That was then superseded by what was called the miasmatic theory of disease, the idea that disease was actually transported in these poisonous vapors. And that's why you have such a rotting smell around carcasses and gangrene and such. The idea that you could get seriously sick drinking water was this radical notion. The idea basically that, you know, you might put a sort of a waste pit right next to a well would actually be seen as convenient, right? You can dump your trash and get your water at the same time. That starts to change in the 1840s, 1850s with the rise of the germ theory of disease. And the central figure in that, it's a fascinating story, is a guy called John Snow. And he was a self-made man. He was from York. And he was convinced that water was the sort of the carrier of diseases. He was sort of an early insight into the notions of the germ theory of disease, but no one believed him. The Lancet, which was the leading British medical journal, basically dismissed his ideas as ridiculous. He was quite influential, though, as a doctor. He was he administered chloroform to Queen Victoria. She was the first royal to deliver a child while she was anesthetized, and as you can imagine, that was a pretty dangerous procedure. So obviously, he was well regarded as a doctor, but he can't prove to the medical establishment what it is that actually he can't prove to them that water really is the source of these diseases until 1854. There is a breakout of cholera around an area called Soho in London. And there had been a change in the law about 10 or 15 years earlier that required the authorities to record the details of someone when they died, their name, their age, where they had lived. Prior to that, it was very similar to sort of Monty Python and Bring Out Your Dead. People would die and they would just be carted off and no one really knew who they were or where they'd been. So Snow goes to the records and he then creates something that's been called the ghost map. Since then, he basically would put a black mark on the map of where these people lived. And what he found was that all the deaths were centered around a single pump called the Broad Street Pump. But there was a problem. And the problem was that two of the deaths of cholera at the same time were nowhere near Soho. One was 8 miles away. One was 11 miles away. And so he's a very careful researcher. So he goes to visit the house of the woman who's died 8 miles away. And he's talking to the woman's son, sharing his condolences. And his son just mentions in passing that she used to live in Soho. And she so enjoyed the water from the Broad Street pump that her servant once a week would go to the pump and actually carry water back to her house. So Snow's getting very interested at this point. And it transpires that the man's aunt had recently died as well. And she had been to visit just a week before where she also had drunk the water. So Snow goes back to the city authorities for Soho, tells them what's going on. They shut down the pump. And it's the first example in history of authorities taking actions to stop a waterborne disease. And it's the birth of the field of epidemiology. And until recently, in fact, the symbol for the International Society of Epidemiology was a pump handle.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Jim Salzman about his new book, Drinking Water, A History. Now, when did cities start adopting chlorinated water?
That didn't happen until the early 1900s. And public health experts say that that was the single most significant act in the history of public health because there were a lot of very, very dangerous pathogens that are highly susceptible to chlorine. But at the time, even with that, as you might imagine, there was a lot of controversy about whether you needed to do this or not. A lot of city water supplies were filtered at the time through sand filters. That had started in Scotland a few decades earlier. The water engineers oftentimes were opposed to chlorination, basically saying, look, that's going to suggest that our water is not safe.
Right.
And our water is safe. So the way chlorination gets into the American water supply, I don't know the Canadian story, I suspect it's similar, is that the Interstate Commerce Commission, which basically controlled railways, they required that all water that was taken on in common carriers had to be chlorinated. So what that meant was that every stop along the train line and later along bus lines, mainly it was trains, every depot stop had to provide a source of chlorinated water. And of course, the trains run all over the country. And so in order to comply with the with this government regulation, these communities chlorinated their water whether they really wanted to or not. And obviously, you know, once they started chlorinating their water, the incidences of, of these diseases dropped off dramatically.
Now, you mentioned that it was controversial. Was it controversial in the same way that maybe fluoride would be?
I mean, the answer is yes and no. Chlorination was dealing with was trying to address these pathogens that could kill you and did kill you. A lot of people died from waterborne diseases. Fluoridation was dealing with a sort of second order, second level concern, which was tooth enamel. And there were these studies that were done in the 40s in Michigan that showed that fluoridation in the water strengthens your bones, strengthens tooth enamel. And so the idea was to add small amounts of basically fluoride to the water. That's the fluoridation you're talking about. There was a very strong opposition against it, and the opposition actually continues, which I'll get into in a sec. But the opposition against fluoridation in the 50s was very much in line with folks who also were opposed to government provision of public health and government vaccines. And it was seen, some said it was a communist plot, but more seriously, I think a lot of people were concerned about Big Brother. And the notion that government basically was intruding fundamentally not into people's lives, but into people's bodies. And so it was very much of an ideological opposition. There is a lot of concern about fluoridation today. I was giving a book talk just last week, and this person came up to me afterwards and started saying she loved the book, but she said I had fluoridation wrong, and that fluoride in the water actually causes enormous problems today, and there's, she said, it's linked to autism and such. You know, I've started looking into this. I haven't found any scientific papers that back that up, but there's a lot of concern even today, from some parties at least, about fluoridation. And you know, the idea that people are unhappy, are uncomfortable with the idea of these minerals or chemicals being added to their drinking water without their control. Chlorination today, interestingly, is also controversial to a certain extent, but for a different reason. When chlorine comes in contact with organic compounds, it can produce a series of chemicals called trihalomethanes, and these are carcinogenic. And so chlorine raises what's called a risk-risk dilemma, right? So you put the chlorine in the water because you want to address the risk of waterborne diseases. By doing that, you create a countervailing risk of these carcinogenic substances, trihalomethanes. Now, experts tell us that the threats that we face from chlorine, typhoid, these other waterborne diseases, Giardia, are much more serious than the threats that are posed to us by drinking trihalomethanes. But there's a risk there. And like many things in life, it's sort of pick your poison.
Now, the book isn't just about water treatment. I don't want people to get that idea. It also talks a lot about water distribution. So tell us about the rise of the drinking fountain, because I had no idea.
Yeah, so that was a really fascinating story. I'd written most of the book, and suddenly just one day I was driving, I thought, oh my gosh, I haven't written about the drinking fountain. How can you put a book on drinking water without the drinking fountain? So the drinking fountain was an example of great ingenuity. There are sort of two main inventors. One of them was basically inspired to create a drinking fountain because a family member had died from unsafe drinking water. And you have to realize that prior to the early 1900s, 1910, 1920s, when you start to see drinking fountains, prior to that, there was public water available. But the way it was distributed was there was a cup or a mug that was chained to a faucet, and you would fill the cup from the faucet and drink it. And you still find that in some parts of Asia today. And so you find these, the book has some pictures of these, but you find these public health campaigns in the early 1900s that basically show a mug in the shape of a skull that's chained to the drinking fountain, you know, or you have, you know, the Grim Reaper with his bony arm around a little girl who's drinking out of a cup at a drinking fountain. And the idea is basically, this is a bad idea. Don't do this. And in fact, that actually explains the origin of the Dixie cup, because the idea was you wanted these very cheap disposable cups that you could use at these places. So that's the sort of the context in which the drinking fountain is created. So one person, one of the inventors, it was basically invented simultaneously by two different people. One did it because he was concerned because a family member had died. Another did it because he worked in the Berkeley, California public school system, and he was concerned about kids getting safe drinking water. And so the idea basically is you have this fountain of water that goes straight up, which, if you think about it, is a very counterintuitive idea, that that's how you would get your water. And so in time, you know, so initially you got these basically, that's why it's called also the old term for a drinking fountain, it's called a bubbler, because there's literally a bubbling fountain that went straight up. Over time, they cool it by having these massive sort of chests that have these big blocks of ice, and that cools the water. You can also, in time, the drinking fountain then sort of gets bolted into the wall. You can also then see the drinking fountain actually going recessed into the wall, so you get more space. And then the latest development is drinking fountains at different level, so the people who are in wheelchairs can drink easily as well. But one of the things that the drinking fountain just continues to evolve, and I think one of the most interesting questions your listeners can ask themselves is, when is the last time they saw a drinking fountain?
Exactly.
Because in the States, the drinking fountain seems to be going the way of the payphone. And I will challenge any of your listeners to find a drinking fountain that is near a food court. And the answer is, you won't, right? Because we think of it more and more, we think of water as a commodity, as something you buy. I mean, when I was growing up, I grew up in the 1970s, excuse me. And if I'd gone to a gas station and asked for some water, they would have pointed me outside to the hose that's used to fill the radiator. I mean, the idea of selling a bottled water at a gas station in the 1970s was ludicrous. And now people expect to buy their water and don't give it a second thought. So one of the wonderful stories I came across when I was researching the book, the University of Central Florida, it's a big university in the middle of the state of Florida, they had a big-time football team. And so they built a big-time football stadium, $45 million stadium. I think it's 1996, 1997. And security takes water away when people enter the gates. They say it's a security issue. So the patrons for the very first game, this is in Orlando, Florida, where it gets hot and humid. They go in for the very first game against the University of Texas. It's a big game. You know how many drinking fountains there were in the stadium? There were zero in the stadium. The idea was either you get drinking water by cupping your hands in the bathroom, which I think most people didn't really want to do, or it didn't occur to them, or you bought it. And the very first game, 18 people were sent to the hospital from heat stroke. And what's amazing is that you could build this huge structure, and not only would it not occur to anyone not to put in drinking fountains, but they actually considered water to be a profit center.
You're tuned into Skeptically Speaking, and I've been talking with author Jim Salzman about his book, Drinking Water, A History. And we'll be back with more of that after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Jim Salzman, the Samuel Fox Mordecai Professor of Law and the Nicholas Institute Professor of Environmental Policy at Duke University. We've been discussing his book, Drinking Water, A History. Now, it seems like water safety is almost as much of a concern now as it was then. So has our perception of what constitutes water safety changed?
There's no question that conceptions of safety have changed not only over time, but also spatially, depending on where you are. And we can go into this later, but obviously our conceptions of safe water are different in Bangladesh compared to Canada or the U.S. But even in North America, a lot of people are concerned about the safety of their drinking water. And there are sort of two ways, really, to think about that. From a historical vantage, our drinking water is safer than it has ever been in human history. I mean, it really is, from a historical perspective, it's nothing short of miraculous that you can go pretty much anywhere in Canada or in the U.S., turn on the faucet, drink a glass of water, and not give your health a second thought. I mean, it's quite stunning that, that you can do that, because throughout history, that was not the case by any means. That said, people are concerned about what's in drinking water. They're concerned about medications, about personal care products, and obviously pesticides and other issues as well. And so we can go into that a bit if you'd like.
Well, and I was going to say, before we get there, this actually has a lot to do with just the fact that technology has improved so drastically.
That's right. So technology in two senses. Technology in terms of treating water, so that how water is treated is much more sophisticated than ever before, but equally technology in terms of monitoring and measurement.
Right.
So we're now finding things in our drinking water that probably were there, have been there for a very long time, but we didn't know about it. And, you know, ignorance is not always a bad thing. And so if you find something that's parts per billion or parts per trillion, should you be concerned about it? So, for instance, Reader's Digest, I think about 2 years ago, their cover basically had a glass of water, and then in big letters said, warning, this may contain rocket fuel, pesticides, birth control, whatever. I mean, you can imagine the list. And the idea basically is to freak you out when you read it. And of course, what they're saying is both true and untrue. It's true in the sense that if you actually do a chemical assay, you will find trace elements of those. In fact, if I were to do an assay of the fat of any of your listeners out there, I would find anywhere from 40 to 50, maybe even more, synthetic chemicals in their fat. That's the world we live in. So it's true to say that drinking water and our own bodies have a lot of synthetic chemicals, a lot of man-made chemicals. But it's untrue in the sense that it doesn't mean it's necessarily bad for us. There are a lot of naturally occurring compounds that can be bad. The question is, what's the concentration? So a thimbleful of chlorine in a barrel of water, that makes it safe to drink. A cupful of chlorine, if you drink it, it'll kill you, right? The dose determines the poison.
So then, as our ability to detect what's in our water changes, so does our definition of safe?
That's right. That's exactly right. And there are new things to be concerned about. And so this is one of those areas, and this is one of the more interesting things I wrestled with in the book. This is one of those areas in modern society where you really just have to trust the experts. Right? It's very difficult for any individual, first of all, to even know what's in their drinking water. Right? You have to order your own assay of the drinking water. But then to know, even if you know what's in it, and you know the concentrations, is that dangerous or not? What's the dose response curve for these types of things? Is this a carcinogen? Maybe, but is it carcinogenic at extremely low levels? And for some of these things, in fact, for many of these compounds, we're talking about the equivalent of a drop of water in many Olympic-sized swimming pools. So it's there, and our measurement techniques are so sensitive that we can find it. But the question is that something that we should be concerned about? And, you know, the government in the U.S., we have the Safe Drinking Water Act. I'm sure in Canada you have an analogous piece of legislation. We rely on the government to protect this. My own view, and what I tell people when I give these public lectures, is that what we eat poses a much greater threat to our health than the water we drink. Obesity and diabetes, I think, are much more serious concerns. That doesn't mean you shouldn't be concerned about the water that you drink, particularly if you drink well water, which is not being tested continually. But to a certain extent, with our drinking water, we have to trust our local authorities or private providers if it's provided privately. And a lot of people feel uncomfortable about that.
So that's North America, but that is definitely not the case in other countries. You actually wrote about the program in Bangladesh to shift domestic water sources from surface water to groundwater. Tell us about that and the awful.
Yeah. No, it's quite a sobering story. Let me sort of frame the issue though. In North America, we give no thought to the quality of our water, the quantity of our water, or the accessibility to water. Right. Basically, we just walk over and we turn on the faucet and drink as much water as we want. And basically, we assume it's going to be clean. We assume it's going to be provided to us, and we assume we're going to pay very little to get it. It's easy to get. All three of those assumptions are false, are flipped on their head in most of the developing world. Drinking water is not safe in many parts of the developing world. It is a personal responsibility to actually get the drinking water in many parts of the developing world, and it's labor intensive. And so Bangladesh, as you mentioned, Very populous country, very poor country, terrible problems with monsoons and such, and the contamination of surface drinking water sources. And so in the 1990s, in a program that was funded largely by the World Bank and other financial and international financial institutions, these steel tube wells were put in, were dug in all around the country, very simple, because the groundwater was safe. The groundwater was not contaminated with microbes. And this was really held out as a poster child for development, because all of a sudden, you know, this country's population now had access to clean drinking water. We can talk in a bit about why that makes such a difference in society. But to stick with Bangladesh, so this was seen as an enormous success story. What the engineers and the planners had not realized, however, was that the geology of Bangladesh, you have naturally occurring arsenic. And so the groundwater actually was seriously contaminated with arsenic. And so it's led to what many have called the largest example of mass poisoning in world history, where essentially the people drinking the tube well water are poisoning themselves with arsenic. Not poisoning so they drop dead, but drinking enough arsenic so that there are serious health effects, or at least that's what the public health experts fear. So that's the tragedy. What makes it interesting and worthy of I think of further consideration is what happened next. So the public health officials went and they tested the tube well water, and some of the tube wells, the water was contaminated with arsenic. Some of it wasn't. Obviously, the geology varies. So they would paint the tube wells that were fine green, and they would paint the tube wells that were contaminated red. And what they found was, even after doing this, many people still got their drinking water from the red tube wells. And so you think to yourself, well, that's crazy. They must be foolish. But it's not that simple. There's a very complicated cost-benefit analysis that these people are undertaking. If they spend time to get safer water from a distant source, that's productive time they can't use for something else. If they take water from a local surface source, there's a good chance they're going to get sick soon, and they know that as well. And so it's a very complicated situation where they basically are balancing really bad situations one against the other, one bad outcome against the other, and choosing what they feel for themselves is the less bad outcome.
Well, you mentioned the ramifications.
Right. So in most areas of the developing world, as I said, getting drinking water is a personal responsibility because the infrastructure either doesn't exist or it's intermittent. Right, it works for about an hour a day or 2 hours a day. And so what happens is that members of the household are given responsibility for getting drinking water, either waiting, you know, by the pump for when it operates, that 1 or 2 hours a day, or more often going off-site to either a local source, which it may not be that local, or to go purchase from a water vendor. There was a study done in East Africa that found that the average travel time to get water was 90 minutes a day. It's much longer in other parts of Africa. And this responsibility falls almost entirely on girls and women. And so when you talk to development experts and, you know, you say, so what are some of the single things that could be done to really increase the productivity and the quality of life for a community, invariably they will say access to clean drinking water. And the reason for that is it basically frees up an enormous amount of time for these girls and the women to use their time more productively, whether it's in education or it's working or it's starting small businesses. Essentially, they are chained to, in a manner of speaking, to the water source. And, you know, they spend hours doing this every day.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Jim Salzman about his new book, Drinking Water, A History. Now, this is interesting because in more developed countries where the water is by most accounts and in most instances safe, many people have basically abandoned tap water in favor of bottled water. What's the history there?
Well, I have to start off by saying sort of this was the spur for why I wrote the book. I was teaching a class on the Clean Water Act, and I was just kind of riffing, mentioning to the students that, you know, how remarkable it is that, you know, more people can get access to clean drinking water from their tap today than ever before. And as I said that, I looked around the room, and over half the students had bottles of water sitting in front of them on their desks. And I thought, well, that's weird, right? I mean, if drinking water is safe, why are you buying bottled water? So the more I looked into it, the more I realized there was really an interesting book waiting to be written, not just on bottled water, but on drinking water. more generally. So the story of bottled water is really interesting. It's actually the single most interesting fact I found in the entire writing of the book. And I won't put you on the spot. I'll ask a rhetorical question. And that is, what's the oldest example of the sale of bottled water? Pause. It turns out that the answer is about 1500 years ago, and it was holy water. So what you find is that in virtually every culture, when there is a spring, naturally occurring spring, there's almost always some kind of creation myth. There's some kind of deity associated with that. And you think about it, what could be more supernatural, more bizarre than water just coming out of a rock? And so the early Christian missionaries knew this. And one of the very first things they do when they went to a new territory was to change the creation story and put a saint in place of the local deity. And over time, these became sacred holy places. And so Chaucer, you know, was talking about the Canterbury Tales, these pilgrimages. A lot of the early pilgrimages actually were to holy wells. And the early church realized this, and they would build monasteries and churches around there, and they would take offerings, and they could be sizable. There are written stories about these lock boxes to protect the take. The King of England in 800 basically forbade pilgrimages to holy wells, and people just ignored him. Now think about Lourdes. Think about Lourdes today in France. It's got the second highest number of hotel rooms outside of Paris in the entire country. And so what would happen is people would go to these holy wells, and then they go back, return home, and they would say to their friends, look, here's holy water from Glastonbury or from wherever. And their skeptical neighbor would say, yeah, I'm sure. I know that you actually just went behind your hovel to the stream, filled some water from the stream, and now you're asking us to believe that it's holy. So the question is, how did they address this issue? And the answer is that all of these holy wells had these special kilns right next door that would produce these bottles with a specific stamp, and that's what you'd put the water in. And so you could only get this stamp at this particular holy site. And it's the first example I've ever found of branded bottling, where basically this is long before Perrier's, you know, green bottles. And there's pictures in the book actually of these flasks from a holy well in Egypt from about 400 AD. So obviously that's not the origin of the modern bottled water market.
Well, no, but it's very similar.
Branding was
involved in the entire life of bottled water.
That's right. And so the next sort of big rise of bottled water comes in the 17 and 1800s when Europeans and some Americans, and mainly Europeans, are going to the spas to take the waters. It turns out because these waters basically come up through geology, a lot of minerals dissolve in them, and they actually can have quite effective medications, depending on where they're coming from. And so people would sort of take the waters in Bath and Baden-Baden and Vichy and these other places. And with advances in bottling technology in the 1800s and freight, rail freight, you actually could take the waters from the spas, and that's where you get the first market for bottled water. It's essentially bottled spa water, and it's primarily medicinal. People like the taste, so that market develops, but it's mainly a European market, and it continues today. In the U.S., there's a bottled water market, but that's because the water you're getting from the municipality isn't safe to drink. So chlorination in the early 1900s knocks the bottom out of the bottled water market in the U.S. and in Canada, I'm sure. Fast forward to the 1970s, and I said if I'd gone to a gas station and asked for some water, they would have pointed me to a hose outside. So what changes? What changes is that Perrier brings in much more money than any other bottled water company has ever done, and they have this massive marketing campaign for bottled water, and they're incredibly lucky because this coincides precisely with the fitness craze and aerobics and the art of running. And bottled water just takes off. People see it as a healthy substitute to soda. And so Nestle ends up buying Perrier. More importantly, Coke and Pepsi enter the market. Coke is Dasani and Pepsi is Aquafina. And they use clear plastic bottles. And you now have bottled water accessible through mass distribution chains. So when you go to a cooler at any store or gas station, next to Coke and Pepsi and Diet Coke and Diet Pepsi is Aquafina and Dasani. So it's a mass distribution chain. And so people a lot of research has been done, why do people drink bottled water, which I should add, now at least in the U.S., rivals soda as the number one beverage in the country. And the profit margin for these things is enormous. And so why do they drink it? Well, partly it's convenience, because the drinking fountains are hard to find.
Right.
And people don't like carrying a thermos around with them, although students are doing that more and more. That's interesting how that taste has changed. Second is it used to be seen as chic, right? I mean, Madonna said she would only take a bath in bottled water. And the last, which I think is the most interesting, is people say is health. Now, clearly, you could say bottled water is better for you than drinking soda or juices or other drinks that have a lot of sugar and other things in them. But a lot of the push has been from the marketers that bottled water is actually safer to drink than tap water. So there was a wonderful marketing campaign done by Fiji Water. This is water that's shipped from halfway across the world, so we can drink it here. And they said it's called Fiji Water because it's not from Cleveland, which I thought was a pretty harsh
that's not nice.
Harsh attack on Cleveland. But the Cleveland municipality, the water managers were actually very, I thought, very clever. What they did is they funded a study of 30 different types of bottled water, and they found that roughly a third had more contaminants in them than Cleveland tap water. They didn't mention whether Fiji water did or not. So how could they find that, right? I mean, don't you just assume the bottled water has to be safer for you than tap water? And the answer is not necessarily. For one thing, a lot of bottled water is tap water. So that's one thing. The second thing is that, at least in the U.S., bottled water is regulated differently than tap water. So tap water in the U.S. is regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency. Bottled water is regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. And there are far, far less strict regulations for bottled water. And in fact, if bottled water doesn't cross state lines in the U.S., it may not be regulated at all because the federal regulation doesn't apply to it, and many states that don't effectively regulate bottled water. And so, you know, anyone, if it's just local, anyone can basically put water in a bottle and say, you know, Jim's water, here you go. Now, I want to be clear on this. I'm not saying that bottled water is more contaminated than tap water, but
right.
What I'm saying is, in terms of the level of regulation, there's no reason to think that bottled water should be cleaner than tap water, because tap water is tested far more regularly for far more compounds than bottled water is.
Well, what about the taste, though? That's another reason that people give for drinking bottled water instead of tap water.
Well, that's interesting, too. So in Europe, for I'm sure you've traveled in Europe, and I'm sure some of your listeners have, you never find ice in a glass of water. That's a very sort of American thing. The Canadians put ice in water as well?
Indeed.
Okay. So why don't Europeans do it? They don't do it because they say they can't taste the water, right? The cold water kind of dulls your taste buds. In North America, you know, what the bottled water companies realize is we really don't want taste, right? I defy you to tell me the difference in taste between any of the leading flat water brands, whether it's Aquafina or Dasani or Pure Water or any of the others. And the reason for that is these waters are designed to have what's called a flat taste, a taste that's unexceptional. In Europe, by and large, people drink bottled water in part because of the taste. In America and in Canada, it's exactly the opposite. So, for instance, when Aquafina and Dasani, those essentially are municipal water that is basically put through a series of fine filters. So they take all this stuff out of it. But what they do is they then add some minerals. In the trade, it's called pixie dust, to give it back a little taste. Because with no taste at all, it actually doesn't taste very good. New York City does this all the time. They have these blind taste tests. And invariably, New York City water does better in terms of what the folks say they like to drink blind than bottled water.
So then really the only reason that people do drink bottled water is marketing and convenience, because we are a lazy, lazy people?
Well, I think fitness as well. It depends what your choice is, right? So if you're deciding whether you want to, you know, you're not in a situation where you can go to a water fountain and you want to have something to drink, you know, it strikes me as a reasonable choice. But here's the thing that's so interesting about this, because there's a lot of cultural aspects to this. So one of the biggest knocks against bottled water is its environmental impacts. right? The fact, you know, you're shipping water from right. Fiji to drink, you know, and the number of bottles, the effect on aquifers of pumping out the water, the climate change impacts, shipping the stuff all over the place. And those are all valid concerns. But here's what I find interesting, and I'm curious whether your listeners would agree with this or not. Soda offers almost identical environmental concerns, almost identical, right? Most of soda is water,
right?
And you're pumping it from somewhere, and you're shipping it somewhere, and you've got bottles and cans, and yet no one talks about the environmental impacts of soda. All they talk about is obesity. And with bottled water, they talk about, you know, the environmental impacts as though, you know, it's immoral to drink bottled water, but no one gives a second thought about soda. And I haven't really gotten a good explanation for why that is. I think that's the case. And I think it's curious. Why
it be
is that?
Because people think that drinking soda is already bad for you and you can't be expected to take care of the environment if you're already doing something that's bad for you.
Maybe. I mean, what resonates with me is the idea that the idea of drinking bottled water is somehow superfluous, right? That it's an unnecessary act, and even worse, it has environmental impacts because it's an easy substitute, right? You can't turn on your faucet and get Coca-Cola, at least not yet. And so the idea maybe is that there's this sort of cultural approbation against drinking bottled water. I don't really have a good answer to this, but I find it really curious that the environmental rap against bottled water is really strong, and there are good reasons to be concerned about the environmental impacts of bottled water, but soda seems to get a free ride.
Now I'm curious. Listeners, if you have any opinions on that, do go to the show comments at skepticallyspeaking.com. And this is, we have so much more to talk about, but we are basically out of time, Jim. Thank you so much. And anybody who wants to listen to way more stories about water, do pick up the book.
And if I can give a plug for the book, I've got a website called drinkingwaterhistory.com. That has links to other issues if folks are interested in following up on the story. I mean, it may sound a little pretentious to say so, but the history of drinking water is the history of civilization. I mean, it's who we are.
Jim, great to have you here.
Thanks so much.
And you can also find a link to Jim Salzman and his book, Drinking Water, A History, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be back with more on the future of water after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're taking a closer look at the code that runs our computers and permeates so much of our lives. Guest host Rochelle Saunders talks to software professional Mark Bennett about his passion for programming and coding as a career or as a hobby. And we're joined by Sergey Maslov, a researcher in computational biology at the Brookhaven National Laboratory, to learn about the similarities between computer code and genetic information. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm Desiree Schell. My next guest is Jiwen Liu, an assistant professor at the Department of Chemistry at the University of Waterloo, and a member of the Waterloo Institute for Nanotechnology. He's interested in studying DNA functionalized soft materials and nanomaterials for analytical and biomedical applications. Thanks for being here, Jiwen.
My pleasure.
So you have figured out a way to use DNA to clean water, which is lovely. Tell us about that.
Well, I guess it's not exactly using DNA to clean water, which would be really costly. It's more of a technology. We use DNA or specific DNA sequences that we can obtain through a selection process. We can obtain those DNA for specific contaminants in water because there are many new contaminants and there are also many old contaminants that you need the technology to recognize all of them. And DNA doesn't sound to be a very interesting molecule to most people. It's just a story of genetic information. But when it comes down to stability, DNA is great. Now we can have DNA that is stable. Thousands of years ago, you can still get information. So it has good chemical stability. So we use that, and we chemically manipulate it to obtain the sequence. Then we can do the screen and get the DNA. So once we have the DNA, then we conjugate it to different materials, including many soft materials you just mentioned. And it's the materials that they can suck up the contaminants. But the DNA is mostly for sensing the presence of those molecules.
Well, how does that work?
So the DNA, they can, when it binds to something, it can fold into a particular conformation. And there are many different ways to detect that conformation change. And for example, you can use a molecule that emits fluorescence, you know, which is a physical phenomenon. And binding, for example, to mercury may induce a fluorescence increase. And you can see that either by just with the naked eye, or if you want more sensitivity, use a fluorimeter to do that.
So how do you determine which specific, I guess, sequence of DNA would bind to a particular contaminant? How do you figure that out?
Oh, that's a very good question. So DNA is what we call a polymer, and it's basically built, repeating units of four base. So it only have four possibilities. We call it A, T, C, and G. So the whole human genome, which contains like about 3 billion base pairs, is basically made of these four bases. So the question is, when out of these numerous possibilities, how can you find a good sequence that can recognize a particular contaminant, such as mercury or some pesticides? So what we do is we start with a huge random DNA library, which can contain hundreds of trillions of DNA molecules. So that can be made through chemical synthesis. So that's very easy. So once you have that library, then you mix it with the target molecule that you want to bind. Usually the target molecule is fixed on the surface, so it cannot move. When the DNA can bind to the target molecule, the DNA also binds to the surface, so it's retained. Those sequences that cannot bind, they're just washed away. Then you have those very few sequences that can bind. And the beauty of DNA is you can amplify it through just a single copy. You can get millions and billions of copies using a technology called a polymerase chain reaction, also known as PCR. So that is the same technology that policemen use to do a forensic assays to figure out who's the murderer, that type
right.
of applications. So it's the same technology. And then we use also a few copies, we can amplify them and go back to the high DNA density, but the population is not as diversified as the initial round. So we can go through this cycle by cycle and increase in the stringency of the selection. So it's just like a human natural evolution, right? So only winners can survive. So you give them some pressure, and winners survive, losers, they are just removed. Then you may introduce mutations in the process, because copying DNA is not exactly 100% fidelity. So you may make some errors. So sometimes it's good errors. It can improve the performance even better. So throughout this process, we can obtain basically good binders.
So what is this process intended for? Is it aimed at cleaning wastewater to make it drinkable?
This technology was originally developed to do, for example, therapeutics, like biodiagnosis. For example, detecting cancer cells, detecting metabolites in the body, bind to proteins that are harmful to the cells. So it's intended for this type of applications. So it's only in recent years it was realized that you can actually use them also for environmental applications, such as removing and detecting contaminants in water.
Would it work on something like oil spills?
I think that would be tough, because those things are not very miscible with water, right? So you want the DNA to be dissolved in water, and other things should also be dissolved in water. So greasy stuff probably is not the best thing.
So this research is still in its early stages, correct?
I would say so. There are many promising fronts, I would say, or examples. For example, we have done sensors and materials for removal of mercury and lead. There are also other sensors that can do uranium, copper, but it's still in the early stage, I would say.
just to sort of give me a sense of how this works, how much water could you currently clean?
Actually, we have made some calculations. It's probably useful for a bottle of water that you can buy in the supermarket, about 500 to 1,000 milliliters, or about 1 liter of water. That's doable. If you talk about a large capacity, like in a lake, I don't think that's the right technology of using DNA this type of materials to do that. It would be just way too expensive at this moment. Maybe the future developments that can overcome the cost issue.
So is that something that you're pursuing, or are there better methods to do larger amounts of water?
Yeah, I think that's just when you develop more cost-effective materials and with the right affinity still and to achieve this goal.
So then what would you use something like this for?
Currently, we're using hydrogels, which are some organic polymer-based. There could be applications that can come from natural bio-based materials, cellulars. Those are really abundant and cost-effective. So now Canada is really big on this bio and the natural resource-based industry. So these are probably good opportunities there to drive application also in the environmental sector.
So when you would develop something like this in a lab, how does one go about getting it out into the world?
Well,
is that a big question?
In academics, we are more interested in academic curiosities, right? So when you really want to do something real, more practical, which is often the case for companies, so the ways to do that, we collaborate with company, or we can start our own company when the right project is successful.
So is that something that you're pursuing?
Not at this moment. When I was a PhD student back in Illinois, Urbana, based on the DNA technology, my supervisor and I did start a company that is actually selling some water detecting sensors. Now you can actually buy through the company. So, I mean, there are possibilities like this, but it does take a lot of effort and time to do that.
We'll check back in a few years then.
Sure.
Thanks very much for the interview, Juan.
Oh, it's my great pleasure.
You can find Juan Liu and his work at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, please do click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, so that you can keep up with show news, and of course to iTunes, where you can download past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Before we wrap up this week, I wanted to let you know about a new way that you can be a part of the Skeptically Speaking experience. If you've ever wanted to ask a question or raise a topic with a guest on the show, you are going to get the chance. We've created a page on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com/ask, where you can submit questions for our guests to answer. We'll post information about upcoming interviews, including informative links, deadlines to submit questions, and a handy place to email us a question for a particular episode. Then, when we record with our guests, we'll have your always thoughtful questions to include in our interviews. We'll let you know on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+ when we schedule a new recording. And do check out skepticallyspeaking.com/ask for more details. Thanks in advance for your questions, and thanks, as always, for listening. We'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. You call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online, reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media.
Our guest coordinators are Rochelle Saunders and Ed Haynes. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. Helen Quivillon is our publications coordinator. Ryan Bromsgrove is our production manager and assistant editor. Josh Witten is our researcher. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.